Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Navarapu, the host of this channel, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being in conversation with Matangi Krishnamurthy, the author of 1800 Worlds, The Making of the Indian Call Center Economy. This wonderful book was published by Oxford University Press in 2018. Matangi is an assistant professor of anthropology at the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras, and this is her first book. Before we proceed, I'm tempted to share with our listeners that this conversation is a bit of a reunion. Matangi was my master's thesis advisor at Indian Institute of Technology, Madras. So I'm doubly excited to have her on the show. Matangi, congratulations on this awesome book. I have gushed to you several times, but let me just reiterate how engaging and illuminating an ethnography this was. I totally loved it. And welcome to New Books Network.
Hi, Sneha. It's wonderful to be here. As you can imagine, absolute pleasure. I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, so I am thrilled that we've finally got down to it. And Just a disclaimer in, you know, continuing my advisory duties to say it's 1800 words.
Okay. 1800 words.
And that's probably got to do with my stubbornness saying I will only name the book 1800 words, although my editors at OUP were not particularly, you know, on board with this. They was like, 1800, what does that mean? I said, it's all right. It is going to be 1800 words.
Yeah. So what does it mean? If you could tell us, it'd be great to know the backstory.
You know, it's about transnational customer care executives in India serving people in the US, the UK and Australia. So people that needed to call customer care call a 1-800 number.
Right.
So that's where the title came from. And that's where it was sort of trying to bridge the idea of 1-800 not just being a particular location as in a customer care executive, but also an entire world that I wanted to excavate, so to speak.
That is fantastic. And now I'll never forget that it's 1-800 words. Well, you know, to start this conversation off on a personal note, I guess, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, perhaps how you became an anthropologist?
I know you've heard this story many times, so I imagine it will be a bit repetitive for you. But honestly, it's taken me a long time even to say that I'm an anthropologist. Mm-hmm. Because I started off knowing nothing about it. I have a former life as an MBA, corporate brand management executive, somebody who did corporate communications for a living. Mm-hmm. And I graduated from business school here in India. I started working with a wonderful small little design firm. And this is what I used to do. I used to work with corporations to try and understand the ways in which they wanted to communicate their identities to the world. Mm-hmm. And while I was doing that, which was a really enjoyable and borderline glamorous job despite the long hours, at some point of time, it began to seem like culture featured at the center of corporate machinations, but in a rather mercenary fashion. Mm-hmm. And then I began to be sort of bothered by the niggling suspicion that surely this is not it. Surely life cannot be about this. And at some point of time, it got a little boring. Mm-hmm. A And boredom has always been my litmus test. It's sort of like, I'm bored now, I need to do something else. And I continued to be interested in culture as an artifact and a set of processes. So I started rooting around, looking to see how I might explore this avenue further, A, mm-hmm. and B, how I could do it on someone else's money. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of like, great. You know, how do I do this in a fashion where somebody supports me to read and write? Mm-hmm. And I figured that the best way possible would be to apply to a bunch of grad schools in the US mm-hmm. with absolutely no idea of the rigor that a PhD program might require. Mm-hmm. I was embarrassingly cavalier about it. So I sent off a bunch of applications in earnest. I had no guidance, no coaching. Nobody in my immediate vicinity knew what Anthro in anthropology stood for. Mm-hmm. So I sent out a bunch of applications, and luckily for me, a couple of people betted on them. Mm-hmm. And one of them happened to be my advisor, good friend, mentor, John Hartigan at the University of Texas at Austin. Mm-hmm. Who saw the work I'd done for my master's thesis in management school on a branding of cities. Mm. And John was intrigued. He was sort of like, we could do something with this, and took me on board to work with him. And that was an absolutely serendipitous happening as far as my PhD career was concerned. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it was just me figuring out in the next 6 months whether anthropology was something that I could wrap my head around, whether I actually understood what it was all about, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. But many happy hours later, abetted by John's careful, gentle, stern mentoring, it really opened up the world for me. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've just sort of been trying to do anthropology along with a bunch of other things. And that is a long, short story of how I am an anthropologist today.
That's a great story. And, you know, it's, it just reaffirms my belief in the fact that there are so many different paths that we take to come to grad school. And each of it is just so unique and such an adventure on its own. That's fantastic. So just speaking of adventures and stories and biographies, how was this book conceived, or what is the story of this book?
Okay, so the book takes off pretty much at the end of the last story, which is in the first 6 months I started working, reading anthropology, reading texts, ethnographies, all of it, with no idea that I have to also think about reading theory through a project of my own. Mm-hmm. So when I was informed that that is what I have to do, I started thinking on my feet and I said, what is it that I can find that I know something of mm-hmm. that will not challenge my language capacities? Because, you know, in grad school, we're all poor. Mm-hmm. We don't have much time. We don't have much money. So I didn't have the resources to actually go learn a whole new language and then take it to field elsewhere. I wanted to work in India. And part of it was because of penury, and part of it was very much about really pursuing native ethnography of a particular kind. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind people like Kiran Narayan who say, what is native about native ethnography? And to really rediscover locations in a different fashion. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, around that time, and this was early 2000s when I started grad school, there were a lot of changes happening in India that really challenged one's understanding of socialist India, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Right, 91 onwards, you have economic neoliberalization, which only begins to show changes a decade down the line. Mm-hmm. So around early 2000s, I was very aware of all of these changes in the city that I lived and worked in, which was Pune in Western mm-hmm. India. And there you began to see a burgeoning of these hordes of young people who would leave parties where I was hanging out to say, oh, you're sorry, work calls.
Right.
It was all rather dubious. You're sort of like, what the hell are these people actually doing? Mm-hmm. And then all the discourse was floating around in the air about call centers. It was a whisper network mm-hmm. of a very hopeful kind, unlike the ways in which we talk about whisper networks today. That was a whisper network that was encouraging people to apply to the call center industry. Mm-hmm. And I was rather intrigued by this as a project that brought together a number of my interests: urban India, youth, cultural processes, work, and corporations. Mm-hmm. And my committee was very enthusiastic about it when I first conceived of it. It also seemed to suggest the capacity to do a different kind of ethnography, very much rooted in the idea of a modern global South. Mm-hmm. So I was also interested in writing about modernity in a way that didn't rehash the same old binaries. Mm-hmm. And that was how, in many ways, I thought about the project as a book. I assumed that at some point it would be a book. Mm. So a lot of the book is very much my PhD work, which I then expanded upon at a wonderful postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, mm-hmm. where it was also located in the Institute for Research in Humanities, which allowed me a whole set of different points of view in relation to literature, in relation to textuality, in relation to really reading cultural discourse differently from the point of view of the humanities as well as the social sciences. Mm-hmm. So the long and short of it is a lot of it was just, you know, the kind of radar for gossip that I have, coupled with an anthropological imagination.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's a great way to put it. And the interdisciplinarity of the book really shines, in my opinion. When I was reading it, I just felt like it really spanned a lot of worlds in every which way. Congrats on that. So the book explores how call center workers, young middle class urban Indians, located themselves within, as you put it, the practices, contentious representations, and material outcomes of the transnational Indian outsourcing economy. And in doing so, the book develops a framework of flexibility as a mode of power. I was hoping that you could share with our listeners how you approach the idea of flexibility and why this analytical framework matters to understanding neoliberalizing India.
Sure. Thank you for that question. And, you know, I want to start by also thanking you, Sneha, for that extremely generous and empathetic reading of the book. You know, when you start writing a book, you hope that some of it can speak to people. So it's really heartwarming to hear you say that it did. So thank you for that to begin with.
And it's my pleasure.
And to this question of flexibility itself, I came to in multiple ways. One, I was very interested in destabilizing the idea of youth as one or the other, as extremely canny, extremely mercenary, indulging in call center work merely for the monetary gain, mm-hmm. or on the other hand, very naive, not worldly wise, and being sucked into this plot of international capitalism. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I was witness to how Pune as a city that comprised of a large population of students also possessed a variety of forms of life. Mm-hmm. You know, these students do a lot. They live in dormitories or paying guest accommodations, as they are known. They go to college. They try to upskill, they perform odd jobs, they hang out, they have forms of pleasure. It's a very vibrant locale. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult for me to believe that they're either extremely naive or extremely cunning. I assume, like much of life, that the truth always lies somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And there was so much discourse around call centers. There was so much of a fetish value to call centers at that point of time. Look at these young men and women learning accents, fooling people. Look at tradition being taken over. This is, what is that horrible world where everything that is globalization is taking over the local in a particular fashion? That kind of alarmist narrative was all around us at that moment. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted an ethnographic eye to be located at this place to say, what does a night in the life of a call center worker look like? Mm-hmm. what does it mean to do this work repetitively? What kind of ways does it intersect with the life of work as we know it? And what are the ways in which it is new? If so, how do we describe such newness? Mm-hmm. And how does it also have the capacity to capture the ways in which when you're in your teens or early 20s, everything is new, everything is interesting. Mm-hmm. And if you have the opportunity to explore new and interesting things in this fashion, what do these possibilities do to you? Mm-hmm. Who do you become by whatever is available to you in your immediate milieu? Who is it that you have the capacity to become? And then how do we look at these two together? Mm-hmm. So flexibility to me was, I was imagining it in the way that, say, someone like Stuart Hall speaks about identity. As a provisional set of categories based on what is available to you that you selectively suture yourself into. But the act of suturing involves work. And that work was being spoken about across a number of literatures at that point of time as the capacity to be flexible. Iwa Ong's work, David Harvey's work, the usual suspects, you know the canon.
Right.
And in that work, flexibility was always about the necessary condition to subjectivity in times of post-Fordist capitalism. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to argue that surely the mechanics of flexibility cannot be glossed over. Mm. What does it look like to be flexible? And how is it that certain forms of power can still be detected as flowing through these newly flexible conduits, so to speak? Mm-hmm. So that was my set of provocations.
Mm. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And I felt like the way you were thinking about flexibility was refreshing in that there was a lot of ethnographic detail, but theoretical innovation that one could see throughout the book. In the way you were dealing with these questions that are, in a sense, classical and timeless, right? Moving on to the second chapter that is so memorably titled "Trespassers Will Be Recruited." you say that in the mid-2000s, working at a call center had become so ubiquitous an experience amongst the youth, so much so that, and I quote you, it became some kind of urban rite of passage that seemed to be playing out on the field. So I was curious to know, how did the call center industry become such a desirable industry for the youth? What were the cultural logics of the lure, as one of your subheadings suggests?
In many ways, this realization that this had become ubiquitous only came to me after I spent about 2 months on field. And this experience may be common to you as well. And you have successfully defended. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
And fieldwork must be recent in your memory. So I'm sure you remember that it's sort of in the first 2 months, nobody speaks to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You do not get to be located so easily on field. People don't trust you. People are not sure what you want. So for 2 months, you're wandering around pretty much parched. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then when people start talking to you, it's like they cannot stop. Mm. So at one point of time, it just took that first contact to open up this entire network to me. Mm-hmm. And once I did, it was sort of like every person I spoke to had a relative or a friend or somebody in the family who worked or had worked or was planning to work in a call center. Mm-hmm. And most of these were young, between the ages of 18 and 25 broadly. And I really wanted to investigate, how is it that companies manage this so successfully? Mm-hmm. And you may be aware, Pune is a college town, or used to be a college town, definitely in the early 2000s. And so it was really difficult to imagine that those who otherwise had student lives would completely move away from those priorities to start working in a call center at night and would find it desirable for a multiple set of reasons. So one of the things I started looking at was, what kind of habits did the corporation change? Mm-hmm. what were the ways in which they set up the idea of the call center as desirable on registers that would speak to these young people? Mm-hmm. And this is, I speak about this in the chapter on trespassers will be recruited, which is that the demand for workers was unimaginable. They needed numbers. They needed warm bodies on those seats. So they'd set up these trucks outside colleges with all of these really, really fun pictures of young people working in call centers who all looked some kind of homogenous, global, modern. Mm-hmm. And presenting these options to students who are part of a regular graduate degree, a bachelor's of commerce, bachelor's of arts, around regular colleges in Pune. Mm-hmm. And advertise and say it doesn't take much. All you have to do is speak English and you can show up to work on Monday if you sign these papers on a Friday.
Wow.
And the money wasn't bad at all. It would supplement pocket money. It would also supplement a fairly non-demanding college education. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that has been happening is that education or educational standards in Pune that were thought to be very high at one point of time mm-hmm. had become fairly easy. Now you could show up in mm-hmm. college, you could not show up in college. You just show up for your exams and you're good to go. It became right. something that was easy for a lot of people and did not challenge them. Mm-hmm. And in this scenario, I think call center corporations, their rise was both contingent and canny. It was contingent upon this particular situation of a number of young men and women who needed something a little bit more demanding, perhaps, mm-hmm. and something that promised something. The nature of that something was not known to them.
Right.
But they were curious. They were interested. So the cultural logics of the lure were very much about selling globalization, selling modernity, selling professionalism, mm-hmm. selling the idea that if you become adept at handling call center customers, it's a leg up to a more global life mm-hmm. and in producing you as a more worldly wise person. Mm-hmm. And so often corporations would hold workshops to tell people about the nature of work, and not just for the workers, but often for workers' families.
Wow.
In the early days, they'd get their parents to come to the office and say, look at these, you know, chrome and glass buildings and how global they are and how right. wonderful, and your kids will have this modern environment instead of whiling away their time eating vada pav at the college canteen.
Right. Yeah.
And you can imagine that draws and works on certain sets of both desires and fears. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of the ways in which it's important to remember how intensely social an animal a corporation is. And how it draws upon existing socialities while also creating new ones.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, now that you mention it, I remember I was in high school, and my dad once asked me, he's like, what do you want to do after school? Like, mm-hmm. do you want to become a doctor? Do you want to become an engineer? And I said, I want to be a call center worker and I want to make like 8,000 rupees. And you know, like, there's this idea that I had that I would just join a call center in my college and make money. And yeah, he pretty much shut it down because he said you have to stay up all night, which brings me to my next question, which is about Nocturne. That uh-huh. is chapter 3.
Yeah.
Which is really my absolute favorite. Like, I loved this chapter so much. It was such a riveting page turner. And there are just like so many highlights on my text that I've been struggling to figure out what questions to ask you. But to start, I was really intrigued by how you theorized night work or nocturnal work as both special and banal.
Yeah.
And while I kind of get it, or I can like understand it intuitively, having grown up in India, mm-hmm. could you perhaps for our listeners briefly summarize what nightly work felt like and a few ways in which workers rationalize the demand to invert the relationship between the day and night? But more importantly, how was night work narrativized both as banal but also as special? Mm.
First, I'm delighted you like that chapter. That was a difficult chapter to write. Mm-hmm. And I know we've discussed this a few times before. And part of the difficulty was very much in capturing the both and character of night work. Mm-hmm. So at first, when I first entered the world of call center work, this was the aspect that was most talked about.
Right.
It was very much a, oh, good God, they have to work at night. Oh, it's men and women working at night together. Oh, they travel in cabs together. Yeah. Oh, this nightly work is bad for all sorts of reasons.
So
I entered with a similar kind of orientation towards the idea of night work. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit frightening because it is about inverting your schedules and working all night long and that kind of rigor. It was also exciting in a part clandestine fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like, you know, it's some form of, for want of a different word, it bears the form of rebellion. You don't know what you're rebelling against, but it bears that form.
Right.
It also bears some of the form of heroics because the only people who used to work at night would be men doing night shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, you don't think about things like care work or nurses or the large working underclass that also occupies the night. That had never been part of popular imagination.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. So these are middle class workers who are now given space to go work at night.
Mm-hmm.
So it's some kind of, you know, there's heroics to it, there's excitement to it, there is a Kipling-esque, mongoose-esque, let's go and find out.
Yeah.
Right? So I entered with all of these ideas. But about 1 month down the line, it became routinized in a way that my body groaned against. But it was also extremely sort of efficient. Let's go get the job done. This is what is required to be done. It became internalized in a fashion so quickly that it surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
And that surprise is what I was trying to theorize as banal, which is that the idea of the night being different or being exclusive or being exciting is one of the discursive frameworks through which to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And you also locate it in the cultural logics of the lure, but it's also important to the call center, to the call center corporation, to also simultaneously make it banal so people don't think about it.
Right.
Yeah. And it becomes banal soon enough if it's something that you have to do. And this kind of narrative is available even in my respondents. Kind of the excerpts I've used in the book from respondent interviews where they say it's no big deal. What's a big deal? Why is everybody making it a big deal?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's also at some point of time, it becomes tiring to them to feel it in that fashion.
Right.
You can only feel excitement for so long before you're sort of like, it's just another job. It's not that exciting.
Yeah.
So that simultaneous character of it was a tricky one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these ideas about it, and they're especially gendered, I imagine, these concerns around whether the night is dangerous or not. And you write about sexual crimes mm-hmm. Being one of those issues that people were sort of always talking about mm-hmm. because women were in these cabs with these, you know, in quotes, strange men, code for rural, peri-urban, the other almost, right? They were occupying this proximate space with the other.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, there were, all these sexual possibilities with younger men at these call centers.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways, I guess, were these heroics of banality, gender, of course, but also the dangers and the fears
mm-hmm.
of the sexual geographies of the night?
You know, this question, of course, goes into a whole different territory because we know the multiple ways in which this is inflected by a general understanding of gender and urban space in India.
Right.
Right. And in the call center, of course, this was always the overarching fear.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like something's going to happen. You know something's going to happen. You know something's going to show up in the newspapers because that is the larger kind of narrative constantly around it.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're almost preempting it in some fashion.
Yeah.
And in the call center, gender showed up again in multiple ways that were not just about that spectacular event.
Right.
They were about strictures as to if, for example, in cabs traveling to and from the call center, women were told to sit in the back, never next to the driver's seat.
Interesting, yeah.
All workers were told not to speak too much to the cab driver.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, you would see that young men would often speak most of the time, women also.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of instructions given were about, let's not cohabit with the hired help.
Right.
Which is very much, you know, a classist, racist narrative.
Yeah.
And with the suspicion always on the peri-urban other, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And in this narrative, of course, other forms of gendering that the call center itself perpetuated were never spoken about.
What kinds
of processes are given to women? What are given to men? What are the ways in which certain forms of jobs are not available for women? What are the ways mm-hmm. in which the voice itself is gendered in the call center? How you are told to be assertive, not aggressive, not to speak in a high pitch?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Lest you be seen as incompetent.
Mm.
And the whole other sphere of forms of intimacy that were engendered in the call center itself.
Right.
So gender is inflected in multiple ways, and this kind of anticipation of the spectacular sexual crime was the one that was most spoken about.
Yeah.
But that inflects much more with an understanding of female bodies in urban space, even more so than just gendering in the call center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. And especially your point about voice training and accent training mm-hmm. Being gendered. It's the right moment to then pick up on that thread.
Sure.
And it's in chapter 4 that you examine language training and accent training in particular
mm-hmm.
in relation to the histories, constraints, and desires of the call center workers.
Mm-hmm.
You argue, I think very interestingly, that the language training and the very imagination of English speaking in these spaces has brought about changes in the way English language speech privileges post-colonial subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about the idea of the neutral accent that kept coming up in your fieldwork.
Sure.
And how and why the boundaries that delineate good English have become flexible in call center worlds.
Sure. It seems to me now, as you're speaking, that somehow every chapter seems to be about taking up a popular fiction around call centers and then deconstructing it.
yes, right? And showing like the flexibility of these constructions, if I might.
Absolutely. And it's sort of like, this is what has shown up in the headlines. Let me tell you the real story.
Yes, that's the best kind of ethnographies, though. I loved it.
It was great fun, you know, because again, I started by shadowing this kind of elusive accent training.
Yeah.
Part of my work was very much located in accent training department. So many people had spoken about this that in many ways, what I discovered in the call center was very disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
I was sort of like, oh, this is that famed accent that everybody is supposed to be able to put on so easily. I see no signs of it. And the irony and the absurdity was also very evident to the workers themselves.
Uh-huh.
So there'd be a lot of like banter and leg pulling around this, where one of them would tell the other, "Hey, tera accent marke dikhana." They'd be performing it to each other with great fun,
right?
While at the same time also being under constant pressure to show some modicum of accent every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it became very much a ritual rather than substantive change to start with.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I think over time, because corporations are also, they're also very good at this kind of quick pragmatism,
mm-hmm.
which is part of how they continue their work. And part of it was very much like, okay, this accent is not happening. Nobody's picking it up.
Right.
And this is also partly due to the fact that accent training itself was so perfunctory. The material mm-hmm. that they'd use was from theater, was from English language teaching in schools. sometimes they train workers by showing them Russell Peters videos. So all of it was so half-hearted that by the time I started working in the field, the idea of the neutral accent was very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And the neutral accent was the idea that, okay, you don't need to necessarily do an American accent. You don't need to aspirate your P's, T's, and K's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you need to make sure you're not sounding too Indian.
Mm.
And they even had sort of made a code around this. So the whole idea of Indianness was separated into various forms of what they called MTI-influenced accents, mother tongue influence.
Right.
So if you had a Gujarati MTI, it was considered difficult. A Maharashtrian MTI, the characteristics were broken down.
Mm.
So in Pune, it was very much about Maharashtrian MTIs, mother tongue influences, mm-hmm. are about interchanging your long and short vowels.
Mm-hmm.
So a pen becomes a pain, white becomes white.
Right.
And so they fixed those. It was very small fixes.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much a discombobulation of the body into voice, accent, intonation, and meaning.
Wow.
And this discombobulation is so much part of the general understanding of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to become an entirely new person with cosmopolitan capabilities. You just need to not say white.
Right.
So it was so small, so modular, so piecemeal, that in my understanding, it very much emulated larger understandings and structures of post-Fordist capitalism, which are about modularity and then putting them back together again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other scholars have written very eloquently about this as well. There's Winnie Poster's work. There's Anisha's work, who speaks about the neutral accent as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of those intriguing kinds of re-territorialization, deterritorialization of power mechanics,
mm-hmm.
where you see that suddenly post-colonial English language speech cannot be spoken about in the same fashion, but it's not devoid of structures of power.
Right.
They're just different.
Mm-hmm.
And so language was one of those very, very important things for me to try to excavate and understand. Where is flexibility in this and what does it mean? That now it does not have those same connotations that were familiar to middle class India of speak properly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have a story in the book about this, about going to a place in peri-urban India, where I grew up. I showed up at the bank and somebody looked at my resume.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw a couple of things, including that A, I'm doing a doctoral program in the US, and B, I worked in a call center.
Yeah.
And then the person remarks and says, oh, your English is so good. It must be because you worked in a call center.
Yeah.
And it's so telling to me. It's so telling to me that working in a call center now seems to give you added currency in terms of your language capacities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting moment.
That story was really intriguing and really, really telling, as you put it. So, you know, like through the book, there are stories like these, of course, which drive the point home with so much eloquence and persuasion, but there's also what you refer to as a nostalgic research design,
mm-hmm.
Or how nostalgia shaped the way you approached your own worlding in Pune.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping that you could say a little more about what it means to do research in a city that one is familiar with,
sure.
or to bear nostalgia for a different order and how it shaped your ethnographic fieldwork.
Sure. And I still struggle in thinking about nostalgia, because honestly, and this is true even when I'm working with other scholars, when I think about their projects or what is at stake in their projects mm-hmm. for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that the projects that really work are where scholars have a deep connection to their own work for one reason or the other.
Right.
And I suspect there is more than a little narcissism involved.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it's true for me, which is in many cases, when I was asking people questions, I was also asking retrospectively that had I been a student in this place and in this time, would I have been working in a call center and what would it have done to me?
Mm-hmm.
And would it still have given me the capacity to inhabit Pune the way I had inhabited it, which gave me great joy?
Right.
So in many ways, I was feeling both curiosity and excitement, but also always already melancholic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because very much nostalgia, the past, melancholia are very much about being unwilling to let go the realities that shape the self.
Right.
And you see it moving away from you so fast and you wonder, does that mean that your subjectivity is not valid anymore?
Mm-hmm.
And so you struggle to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this nostalgia is very much about this struggle to see what is this city that you think of as so dear to you for reasons that are so particular to you, and do you then have the capacity to imagine it differently?
Yeah.
So that nostalgia is a great driving force.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also cautionary in that sense. To be aware of it means that I cannot keep asking the questions in a vein that says, but why are you doing this?
Right.
I can't ask people, but why are you working in a call center? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
because that's part of your wonder. You're sort of like, you can hang out in college and sit around and do nothing. Instead, you're going to a call center. What's wrong with you?
Right.
And so being aware of that nostalgic research design prevented me from feeling that. It allowed me mm-hmm. to feel excited about the call center in the same way that respondents felt excited.
Yeah. That's I think in the book, when you also talk about when you were growing up, having a driver from a very different class background, mm-hmm. but your relationship with him being very different
mm-hmm.
As compared to the ways in which like the driver worker body has been pathologized
mm-hmm.
in call center atmospheres. Like that was also such an interesting way to think about the past. Like, I mean, there was nostalgia, but there was also like this recognition of some kind of change, right? Like a relational change mm-hmm. Between women of a certain class mm-hmm. and men of a certain class. I mean, yeah. No, thanks. I thought it made for a great, great writing, but it also made me think about my own fieldwork and how nostalgia plays into that. And all in all, I thought it was very provocative. So thank you for being so explicit about it, because I think a lot of people might do it, but are not mm-hmm. explicit. And it just being explicit just helps us, you know, emerging scholars think about these things differently. So I really appreciated that.
Thank you. No, and I think even after writing the book, I've thought more about it. And people who've been doing scholarly work on domestic workers, on these kinds of relations, including Raka Ray's work, for example, they
right.
speak about modern South Asia as very much being formed around these different cultures of servitude, as they call it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I grew up in an industrial township that had very clear class hierarchies.
Yeah,
and these were relations of patronage. I will not ever mm-hmm. claim these were relations of equality.
Yeah,
and those relations of patronage were ordered in very different fashion than these kinds of relations of alarmist expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow to me, it's very interesting. I wouldn't call one or the other liberating at all.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the form of intimacy of the former
mm-hmm.
has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And it mm-hmm. might well be a liberatory moment to say that that was false intimacy.
Right.
That was only patronage intimacy of a certain kind and did not bring any possibility of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And so in light of that, I want to see what this new thing is.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do enough work at all on looking at all of the structures that supported the call center, like the cab drivers network at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I know other scholars are.
Right. Well, you know, I was curious to know if your interlocutors had read parts of the book and what they thought of it.
a lot of my interlocutors have, and they're very amused by it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good reaction, I guess.
Very amused by it. They skip around all of the dense theoretical parts.
Yeah.
They love the stories.
Mm-hmm.
They love to point themselves out to me in the stories.
Yeah.
And I think even when I was writing the book, they were active contributors.
Mm-hmm.
They were sort of like, why don't you tell this story? I think this is important.
Mm.
Why don't you tell that one? That says something that I think people are not talking about. You need to write about this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wouldn't go nearly close to saying they were collaborators at all. But key interlocutors were very much involved in my choice of the stories to tell.
Now, I mean, that's wonderful. That's still better than them getting offended or something at their representation. But I think you've done a great job at empathizing with their lives. So I see no reason, but, you know.
Oh, I mean, more than empathy, I think they were the ones who sustained me through call center work. Like, I would sleep in all the time. They would come and ferry me when I missed the cab.
Okay.
They were the ones helping when I was floundering in the call center. They loved participating in conversations about work. They were fabulous.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's like an ethnographer's dream. That's fantastic.
No, they were great. And I'm in touch with a lot of them even now. So we hang out, we chat, we catch up.
Yeah. That's awesome. And, you know, I realized that, I mean, I think this might be a good place to ask this, but I realize that a lot has changed and a lot has not changed in terms of the way the Indian outsourcing economy works today since the time that you were doing field work.
Yeah.
But I think the novelty of the call center life and its public image certainly has dulled, if I might use that word.
Absolutely.
And where are your interlocutors now, or what do you see happening in terms of youth aspiration, mobility and flexibility, say in Pune today?
You know, that's a tough one because I haven't kept up very well with it. I know where my interlocutors are, and I know they are pretty much in and around the software industry. So they've migrated from call centers to software. Some of them have migrated to other service industries.
Yeah.
So hospitality, they've started their own businesses, they're doing some kind of online gig, platform economy. Mm-hmm. So related, but not quite the same.
Yeah.
Because one of the things
really
about call center work is that night work is erosive. You can't keep it up beyond a point. So the attrition rates are high, very, very high. And often for a lot of the women, the urgencies of family do take over. So there's a very clear sort of gender demarcation after a point. So they quit. So the quitting is fairly common. But I do remember a number of them going back and forth, moving from one call center to the other, horizontal attrition of a certain kind.
Right.
And a lot of them really becoming addicted in some ways to night work. And I use addicted very loosely, but it was sort of like, this is a way of life I've become used to. It's great. I don't see a need to switch.
Yeah.
But they're around, but you know, after it, the pyramidal structure of the call center means that if you're a call center worker taking calls, there's only so far you can go before you have to exit. Sometimes to another call center, sometimes to another form of job altogether.
Yeah.
And besides the fact that the call center industry itself has plateaued and moved to places like the Philippines. So even in terms of demand, we have seen falling rates. Broadly, I'm not sure where to locate a lot of them, but they were part of India's movement or aspirational movement to becoming a separate economy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a fantastic wrap up on this. I guess I was just curious where everybody was, and I had a hunch that it would be software, but I didn't want to presume. So thanks for clarifying that.
Good point to take.
Thank you so much for your time, Matangi. What an absolutely enjoyable conversation this has been. Before I let you go, however, would you mind telling us what you're working on currently and what we can expect to read by you in the near future?
Where do I begin with this now? This is always a nightmare question, right? What are you writing? It's sort of like me asking you, Sneha, when is your book going to come out?
Yeah.
But the thing is, there are a number of projects I'm working on right now, all of them in some nascent stage or the other. The one that's most developed is new work I've been doing for the past 3 years on infants suffering a very particular condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Mm-hmm. Which the long and short of it is infants born with what medical professionals call ambiguous genitalia. Mm-hmm. So I've become very interested in categories of gender and sexuality in relation to biomedicalization of bodies.
Okay.
Which might be a very, very long stretch from call center work.
Right.
But it's very much about my ongoing interest in bodies.
Okay.
Part of my work with call centers was very much about saying, what happens to the body when you're working in a call center?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've sort of put together my interest in gender and sexuality with my work on body and tried to see what happens when we look at it in the context of the clinic. And it's been interesting. So I have an article out in East Asian STS speaking about some of the preliminary work.
Okay.
And in a couple of years, if there is something I have to say, it will hopefully be a book.
That's fantastic. And if your first book is anything to go by, I can't wait to read what comes of this.
You are very kind. Thank you. I've enjoyed all your questions and it's been an absolute pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you, Matangi, for coming on the show, and I will speak to you very soon and have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You have a lovely day and talk to you soon.